We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week,
Jurassic Park.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen, and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show. Jeff, this week we are joined by Doug Stewart, CEO of the Libertarian Christian Institute. He's with us now. Hey, Doug, how are you doing today?
Hey, guys. I'm doing great.
Glad to have you, man. We connected with you back in May.
Yeah.
Was it?
Wow. Okay. That was a while back.
I think it was around May. I could be wrong about that. I'm very bad with calendars. But it was early 2023.
Yeah.
And you had us on your show, and it was a great time, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that actually was a huge boost for us, too. We've had listener correspondence where they say, you know, we first heard you guys on Libertarian Christian Institute, and we've been following you since, and you like doubled our numbers overnight. It was great.
That's really good. I'm glad to help. I remember we had a great conversation.
Yeah, and part of that conversation was your love for a specific movie, and so we dog-eared it for you, and we knew that when nice. You were available, this movie was special just for you,
yeah.
And we're excited to talk about Jurassic Park with you.
Steven Spielberg. This is going to be a good one. It's a great movie.
This is like 65 million years in the making. It's in May, right?
I think it's 6,000 years in the making.
Oh.
Uh-oh. And just to get into some of the random facts.
Really starting it off hot.
Oh, gosh. Most of the dinosaurs featured in this movie were actually from the Cretaceous period. And they actually acknowledge
that's
that,
funny,
too.
Right? Yeah.
There's only two dinosaurs featured in this movie from the actual Jurassic period.
Yeah,
I was like, I learned that today in my research.
You know what's funny to me is that with a lot of the animals in Jurassic Park, I was listening to Steve Bersatti's book on dinosaurs a couple years ago. Actually, it was 2017 I was listening to it. And it was like a new history of the dinosaurs or whatever. It's like most of the animals in Jurassic Park would never have existed together.
Right.
Yep.
And that's just such a weird thing to like kind of think of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, this movie is definitely sci-fi, but like it does pose, which we'll get into, a lot of like, there's a lot of things in this movie that are like, could we do this today? I mean, like,
we are doing this.
We
today.
Live in a world where we've cloned sheep and stuff. So I mean, like, in other things now, I assume
they're bringing back the woolly mammoth.
Really?
Yeah, TED Talk linked below where they're talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
Like they're like it. Mm-hmm. How close are they to like?
I don't remember how
is
old
there
the video
baby
is,
woolly
but
mammoth,
like they were talking about it like imminent.
That's all. What I don't
is
know.
It awesome?
I don't know if that's awesome. It's
is it awesome?
I mean,
I think right now they're. I think right now they're probably debating whether or not they should. That's probably at the stage.
Unlike the scientists in Jurassic Park, they did stop to think if they should.
They need themselves a Jeff Goldblum. But yeah, but so before we get into the movie,
we all need ourselves
we've got
a Jeff Goldblum in our lives.
Yes.
I need the Jeff Goldblum from Body Snatchers, though. That's the one I need.
I've not seen Body Snatchers.
All I remember from it is pointing and shrieking.
Oh, okay, cool.
okay.
This is the only, besides like his small features in like the Marvel universe where he's got some small cameos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is the only stuff I've seen him in. I've not seen Independence Day yet. And that's the only other thing I can think of that he's in that I'm familiar with.
And
so this is the only thing I know Goldblum from.
And this is Jeff Goldblum at his Jeff Goldblumist.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
But before we get into all that, every episode we have a guest, we ask them a couple questions just to get to know them and for our listeners to have a better perspective of where they're coming from when we have our discussion here. So without further ado, we got three questions for you. We just want to throw your way and answer however you'd like. But we'll start with, what's your political bias?
My political bias? Well, if it isn't obvious in what I do, given your intro, if people have already forgotten because we've told terrible jokes between now and then, I am the CEO of the Libertarian...
Par for the course.
I'm the CEO of the Libertarian Christian Institute, so I am, of course, a libertarian, and I would wear that label. I do wear that label proudly, and it brings up a lot of different conversation. But essentially what that means is I believe that things that ought to be done with peace and not coercion and violence, and that if there's anything that can be done, it could be done better than it could be done by the government. That means adherence to the non-aggression principle and a respect for private property, which obviously entails a whole lot of other things that go beyond, you know, just those two statements. There's some working out of what do those two things mean and how do they relate to one another. But that's my political bias.
All right. Awesome. That works for me. I think we'll allow that.
We'll take it.
Yeah. Next one. What's your religious bias? Where do you stand when it comes on to things of faith and topics of that matter?
Do you guys ever have anybody on who's like title gives you both answers? Cause I like,
it's been a minute, but I mean, no,
like democratic socialist, you know, representative or something like that.
Cause we've had some pastors on.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so their political stuff would be,
they're a little more cagey about when I understand that.
Right. So yeah, we've not had anyone that has a specific job or role where it's just one, answers both questions.
That's great.
We had Josh Smith on. We had Josh Smith on earlier, and so that gave us, you know, the politics side, but not the religious side.
Yeah, right. All right. So I'll claim that for my own, you know, trophy or whatever, my own Oscar on your, you know, dual honor there. No, I am a Christian. I grew up in a relatively conservative Baptist-ish kind of home church environment. I'm probably would call myself more in the Anabaptist tradition. You know, sometimes I kind of waver between like, would I rather be an Anglican or an Anabaptist? But you know, probably the Anabaptist is probably the tradition I would most align with. Although, you know, generally speaking, that's splitting in a number of ways. You know, in recent years, it could go left or right, depending on who you are and who you know. That could indicate to your audience that I'm left or right. But given that I already said that I'm libertarian, I'm neither left nor right. So, yeah, that's my religious bias.
Really? Question about Anglicanism, because I genuinely do not know. Would that require you to adopt some political views of monarchism?
That's a really good question. I know that the only person that I know who's deliberately, or not deliberately, but like specifically addressed that, it wasn't even really directly. It was N.T. Wright. He was answering a question about, he was just remarking on the Enlightenment as a project. And he's typically a little bit cynical about what happened during the Enlightenment outside of, in terms of spirituality and man's beliefs about relationship to one another and to God. You know, the material stuff, he's kind of like, well, of course we like what happened there, you know, innovation and all that. But he basically made this comment that sort of sounded like it was a disparaging remark about the questioning of the divine right of kings. It was a little, it was like neutral, but like you could interpret him as saying like, oh yeah, and they also question the divine right of kings, kind of frustration. It was just a remark. That's all I got. And he's the only Anglican I've heard talk about it. So you'll have to ask an Anglican what that is. But yeah, I mean, I think the Church of England Anglican, I guess if that's really what it is, you probably would be a little bit more favorable to monarchy. Whereas like Episcopalian in America or whatever would be something different. I'm not an expert. I didn't study for that part of the test, guys.
Okay. All right. Well, final question of the quiz here. What's your favorite movies? How would you describe yourself when it comes to the big screen?
Oh man, I'm of two minds when it comes to like what I like to watch. And as a parent of three kids and, you know, my oldest is right now 16. I have become a little less interested in the art of film as I was in my like 20s. Than I am now. And right now I'm just like there for like, I just need something to entertain me. So like a summer blockbuster would be kind of a nice fit for me. I do like to be entertained. There is that sort of escapism that comes with watching a movie. I do not like what could be called mindless escape, where it's just like, just give me something. I just want to, you know, not think about the cares of this world kind of movie. I mean, I do watch fun movies that are just like literally just fun to escape, and it doesn't need to have a message. You know, like Top Gun Maverick from 2022 was a great film, a great movie, a great blockbuster. It was entertaining. It was all, it like hit all the marks, right? but there was no real message per se. I mean, I know the military industrial complex might have wanted there to be a message there, but there wasn't. I mean, I didn't think so. It was just a fun movie. At least that's how I took it. I realize it kicked up for things for people, you know, if they were already, you know, honoring the military or whatever. But yeah, so I kind of go back and forth between, like, I like to watch films that are artistic and have a message, or have a message that the director or the writer wants to convey, and just simply watching a movie for fun and enjoying it. But I have relatively high standards, medium to high. You know, if this is like a steak, like medium well kind of thing, right? So that's where I am. So my favorite movie. And this is obviously, I wouldn't say obviously, but this is, of course, or understandably, an indication of my age and the time that I came of age, which is the Steven Spielberg's 1993 Jurassic Park. And so, which, I mean, no spoilers here, because, like, you know, it's the title of your podcast, and that's what people tapped on to listen to this, right? So this is not this is not news. But, like, across the room, I'm staring at a Lego set of the scene set in the literally the middle of the film, strategically placed exactly in the middle of the film, where the T-Rex comes out. Yeah.
After we arrived recording last spring, you were showing off some of those Lego sets.
Yeah.
And at first, you were embarrassed. And until you notice that Jeff and I were genuinely impressed and equally excited.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm into Legos to the extent that the current, I don't know what the word is, wave of Lego, like whatever the company is making, that what they're doing is they're doing something very different from what it was when I was a kid, where it was like, hey, just build these little worlds, you can kind of do whatever you want. Now it's like, hey, we're going to engineer toward things that are either nostalgic or have some sort of like artistic purpose or set piece kind of designs. And so I have like the NES Lego model, and I have this like old fashioned typewriter, and then I have this Jurassic Park set. And all of them, like the Legos that I have, are just really more like nostalgia. And I've actually looked for other quote unquote adult Lego sets, and none of them really strike me, at least the ones that are out right now, or they're just a little too pricey, you know, strike me as kind of like, ooh, I want to have that. So anyway, that's but the Jurassic Park thing, I was just like, I have to have this on my shelf. Like this is a film that means a lot to me. For me, it was the film that got me into reading, because once I watched the movie, I was like, well, because in 1993, you couldn't go to the movies by yourself more than once unless your parents took you, right? Or couldn't go the first time unless your parents took you I shouldn't say in 1993. For me, in 1993, I couldn't do that. In 1993, you could do this if you were old enough.
I certainly couldn't have. I was two.
You wouldn't have even understood what was happening. So I wasn't even a teenager then. And my dad took me to see it. I was absolutely amazed. And a couple years later, back then, I don't even know if we had it on VHS or not. But anyway, I wanted to read it. So I read Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, and I fell in love with reading novels. Up until then, I didn't read other than what was assigned at school. And after that, I started reading a lot.
Awesome.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that works.
Now, I know that you've got kids. Have you watched this with those kids yet?
That's a great question. Yes. My son, I don't know what age he was. So he's 16 now. I'm pretty sure he was like 8 or 9 when he watched it with me. And I was a little worried that he'd be afraid. He wasn't. He was just like, Dad, they're dinosaurs. They're extinct. Like, I can't imagine that they're going to come get me in the middle of the night kind of situation, right? Like his brain was kind of like, well, this is what it is. And we actually, I went to see Jurassic World, the first in the second sort of iteration trilogy. Of the trilogies, the first and the second trilogy, which by the way is also a very good movie. I would say it ranks number 2 in my book for all of the 6.
Really? So the first one with Chris Pratt is your second favorite out of the 6?
Yeah.
Right on.
That's how I would do it. I mean, seriously, the film 1, 2, and 3 in each of the trilogies kind of gets successively worse.
I would agree.
I recently
watched through all 6 of them with my kids.
Yeah, so with the first trilogy, 2 and 3 are rough. Mm-hmm. Not unwatchable, but rough. Mm-hmm. The middle one of the second trilogy was weird.
No, it was weird, but it was not really unwatchable. Actually, I thought it was good. The third one was ridiculous, but
I see.
So my kids, Well, let me just answer the kid question. Yeah, so my son, he saw it, he liked it, and I got to see Jurassic World opening night with my wife, and we decided whether or not my son could go see it with me the next day. Because I wanted him to come see it with me the next day. And he did. And it was great. Him and his cousin came along. And so we saw Jurassic World. So there was that. My daughter, she just reminded me that she was 7. She's 14 now. She was 7 when she first saw it. And she told me the other day, because I watched it with our now 11-year-old, which is the third child, who refused to watch anything PG-13 unless somehow by accident she ended up seeing it or someone she trusted. I don't know. She does these like weird rules of like, no, PG-13 can't. I just can't. It's going to be too scary for me. I'm not old enough. I'm not 13. She watched it and she was just like, yeah, it was fine. Like she didn't like love it, but she didn't like, she wasn't scared. And it was a cool experience. So yes, my entire family has now watched it as of this week.
That's fantastic.
And my daughter, my middle daughter, who said I showed her this at 7, she remembers some of the scenes. And she's like, I remember being terrified. Like, she remembers Arnold's arm, right? You know, near the end. And she remembered the jump scene from the ceiling panels, like, where everybody, like, yanks up their feet when that little jump scare happened. And she remembered a few other things. So for 7 years ago and at age 7, it left an impression on her because she's whispering to me the other night about well, doesn't this other thing happen or whatever? I'm like, yeah. So anyway,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I recently watched through all 6 with my 3 kids. My oldest daughter's 9. Then I have 2 sons that are 6 and 4, and all 3 of them absolutely loved it and wanted more.
That's great.
My boys are super into dinosaurs, so that, you know, made it easy.
That helps, yeah.
But one thing I noticed with the franchise, as you said, kind of the second one and third one of both trilogies, it kind of dropped off in quality. And I think the second trilogy kind of does like this meta commentary on why that is. In the second movie, they need this bigger, scarier dinosaur to attract more park visitors.
Yeah.
And so they invent I can't remember what they call it, but they invent this new dinosaur.
Indominus Rex. That.
Yeah. Was that the first one?
That's the first one.
That's the first one, yeah.
But there is an...
And that continues through the trilogy.
Correct, yeah.
And with the movies, each movie, they have to up the ante. They have to jump the shark even more, right? So in the original trilogy, in the second one, now you have flying dinosaurs, right? And in the third one, well, now they've... what was the... How did they raise the stakes?
I thought it was about locusts. That's all I remember. Locusts and
motorcycle.
The third one
in the new trilogy was locusts, yeah. And so like each time it's just like, we're going to raise that bar to draw in more audience. And it's kind of like this meta commentary on what they were doing.
No, yeah. I do know that there's going to be more. It just won't be the Chris Pratt cast. They're going to, because the dinosaurs are now... like
out in the world.
It's like their goal is to tell more stories about people coexisting with dinosaurs.
Flintstones.
Now nothing's been said on that since then.
Are they
going to
consult Ken Ham? Because he knows a whole lot about that.
That's true. That'd be interesting.
What about Ken Hovind? That guy knows his dinosaurs.
Oh man. Yeah, true. I'm surprised people know who Ken Hovind is. Not that we should talk about all that, but like he's a little more obscure. That's good.
I didn't recall that name.
He was he's a young Earth creationist who really likes his dinosaurs, and they put him away in prison for tax evasion. So like all over, I like him. You know, nothing to dislike there.
Wow! Oh my word!
He's a man's man. Good for him. So yeah, let's run through some of the stats of this film here real quick. Jurassic Park, 1993. It runs about 2 hours and 7 minutes. Directed by the Steven Spielberg. It's rated PG-13.
Not just Steven Spielberg.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
We do have to clarify, because in the past we've had actresses married to somebody with a famous name, but it was just a person with that name.
Right.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg, I mean, is known for so many things. Schindler's List, which came out the same year as this movie.
Actually, important note about Schindler's List, when we covered that movie previously, that was with Jacob Daniel Winograd. And he was somebody whose title and credentials gave away both his politics and religious biases.
Oh, there we go. Man.
Host of the Biblical Anarchy podcast.
You want another piece of trivia?
What's absolutely. That?
Both Jacob and I have Jewish heritage.
Oh, do you?
My last name wouldn't give that away because I'm adopted, but yeah.
Well, actually, Jake, Jacob's name didn't give it away either. Somebody else said
fair enough.
Had a Jewish guy for Schindler's List. I was like, oh, maybe. I don't know. We had to ask him about it.
I wanted to actually go back and watch Schindler's List before I listened to that episode with him, but maybe I'll just, because I've seen it. But
yeah. He was a terrific guest.
Spoilers, right?
Yeah. Steven Spielberg, director of many of the great Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, all the Indiana Jones. Well, yeah. I think most of the Indiana Jones. Yeah. If not all of them. Lincoln, War Horse, Adventures of Tintin, War of the Worlds, The Terminal, Catch Me If You Can. There's so many.
And a bunch of those in the top 250.
Icon. The Fablemans.
Yeah. The Fablemans, which is his most recent. And that's why a fictitious is representation of his. Yes.
I love
it. It's a biography, right? Like, sort of.
Yeah,
it is. It's not. I mean, the child is just an avatar for him. It's not his name. Yeah. It's not. Yeah. You know, it's not. It is. I mean, he in talking about the film, it's very much autobiographical. But he uses storytelling techniques to basically tell the story however he wants to tell the story. So not everything is going to be exactly what he experienced as a kid, but it's very close. I mean, it's close enough for. A person to say, for him to say, yes, this is about me. And it is
a Roald Dahl's book boy.
Yeah, that's probably about right. Yeah. That'd be probably a good comparison. But no, the Fablemans is, I just loved it. I thought it was great. We'll talk about that another show.
Yeah.
I've heard of that, but I've not seen that. And, Jaws, he directed Jaws, which is one we've done so far.
Yeah.
So, and the more
ones
to come
left
for
in
him.
The top 250 that we've not yet done. Would be Raiders of the Lost Ark, Last Crusade, and Catch Me If You Can.
Mm-hmm. Amistad, Hook. Like, there's so many movies that are iconic for me personally that are... Hook's one of my favorite movies. But, so Steven Spielberg, let's continue here. So we're now, and I've said this a couple of weeks now, and we're going to continue to do this. As we build up our catalog of movies we've talked about, we're going to kind of retouch on movies that have came out maybe in the same year as the one we're going on, just to kind of get this chronological idea of what movies we've talked about. So Schindler's List and this movie came out the same year, both directed by Spielberg. Wow. And also Groundhog Day came out in 93. Mm. So those three movies, this one and the other two we've currently done. And then one that's not a Spielberg movie, but one we've also touched on the year later was Lion King. 94 was Lion King. So just some notable movies. To mention that are around the time that this movie came out on. We've mentioned it real quickly, but Nelson, just to affirm it, this is based on a book, right?
Yeah. Michael Crichton's novel of the same name. I've not read it. Doug, you said you have?
Yeah, I've read it. You guys want to know how much of a nerd for Jurassic Park I am? I'm going to, not know all the facts, but, I bought the book... to read, and then I was in Mexico on a vacation with my family, and I found it in Spanish, and I bought it, and I was taking Spanish at the time when I was in high school, and I was like, I read a few chapters, and it was like, so I have Parque Jurásico on my shelf.
That's fantastic.
And I understand the book and the movie have quite a few differences.
The book and the movie are probably the closest. I mean, yeah, there's differences in the one sense, but the basic storyline is there. And what disappointed me is that The Lost World, which is a book by Michael Crichton, he wrote a sequel. When they did the sequel to a movie, it was nothing like the main character wasn't even in The Lost World, the movie, which was kind of, I was really frustrated by that actually. Okay. Even though I saw Lost World in theaters three times because by that time I had my driver's license. Jurassic Park the book, it does a lot more Ian Malcolm waxing eloquent and explaining chaos theory. It is primarily a book about the each of the sections starts off with a iteration of chaos theory that's described, and it kind of takes you through order to chaos. And so the book and the movie are pretty close, and they're close enough. I don't know if you've seen The Martian or read the book The Martian by Andy Weir.
I have not.
They're similar enough, and there's certain things that are just shortened, and a few things that they did or didn't do one way or another. So it's similar with Jurassic Park. I mean, I haven't read it in a while. I have seen it more recently than I've read it. But my recollection is there's not a ton. What's weird is in the book, Ian Malcolm dies, and then Ian Malcolm's brought back in the sequel, and it was just like, he doesn't die in the sense of there's a scene where you see him die, but someone says he didn't make it. But then in the book, they sort of, I guess they call it retconned. They kind of retconned the whole thing and be like, yeah, there were rumors that he had died, but he's not. And now he's teaching and explaining why this is a terrible thing. And so all that to say, there are a few small discrepancies, but I wouldn't say it's like this major departure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I remember as a kid waiting to catch the bus for school, and they would have on the TV show The Lost World, which not connected to the Jurassic Park series, but mm-hmm. is based on the book The Lost World. I remember enjoying that, and that was it's the TV show was so different than the movies that for the longest time I didn't even know they were connected. They're like, connected in the sense that they were from the same creator of
Right. Like
same world,
completely different storylines and stuff, like
situations. And that's also not to be confused with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World.
Right.
Wait a second. Maybe that's what. Maybe that's. Okay, I've got a fact check now. I didn't know there was two books called The Lost World. This may.
Mind blown.
All right, I'm gonna look.
That would explain a lot, right?
As we continue, I'll look that up and I'll come back with that later because that. Maybe that's why there wasn't, because I mean it was a show about survival in the jungle and stuff, and just almost like this Partridge Family type thing where they're living on their own means and stuff, and they're surviving and they're discovering.
Yeah,
but there was a minimal. Maybe it was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's.
Maybe. I'll wax eloquent here in a few minutes after a question, and you can Sherlock it and find it out.
I just pulled it up here. Yeah, okay. It's a 1999 TV show called The Lost World, adapted. From the Lost
there you go. This whole time, I thought it was the lot. It was okay.
Was there dinosaurs?
I don't remember. Yes. That I don't remember.
Yeah.
There is. Okay. I just remember being a kid watching. I decided to watch The Lost World when going to the babysitter before I caught the bus. Anyways, notable cast in this movie. We've got Sam Neill, who's in some Thor movies. He plays in the movies where like there's the actor portraying Odin. He's that actor in the two newer Thor movies. He's in Peaky Blinders. He's in Bicentennial Man.
Hunt for Wilder People by Taika Waititi. That's by far my favorite Sam Neill movie.
Okay, I need to watch that. I've not seen that. Good. Laura Dern, she's in The White Lotus. She's in Star Wars The Last Jedi. She's in October Sky. Jeff Goldblum, he's in Asteroid City most recently. He's in some Marvel stuff, Independence Day. He's in Prince of Egypt. Richard Attenborough.
That's right.
Yeah. Richard Attenborough. I was looking through his list. I recognize his name, but I can't.
I don't
know.
It's the brother
why.
Of David Attenborough.
Maybe
it literally. Like, I'm not joking. I'm not, it really is.
I'm not questioning that. I hear that name and I can't connect it to a certain thing.
I know who David
thing.
Attenborough is. Yeah.
So basically, I know the name. Nature documentary by BBC. He's the narrator.
Okay.
Almost every single time.
Okay. So that was that's Hammond. He plays Hammond.
Yeah.
Richard,
which I think is hilarious because you've got a conservationist. And he's played by the brother of the world's probably best known conservationist. Yeah.
Since we're talking about dinosaurs and Attenboroughs right now, David Attenborough actually narrates an Apple TV Plus series. I think it's called Prehistoric Earth.
Okay.
And it is all CGI of what dinosaurs like. It's like a documentary on dinosaurs as if we were there.
Okay.
And my son is into like tech in the sense of like, he's into filmmaking and CGI and like just understanding it. And he can just nitpick about CGI and he could take, he was blown away.
Really?
He's a picky teenager with respect to like, all of that. And so he was even blown away. It's pretty amazing actually. Like it puts all of the Jurassic Park movies to shame in terms of its, technological feats. That's also worth watching.
Yeah.
And there's a T-Rex.
How similar do the dinosaurs look in that production to what we see in Jurassic Park, where they're like large lizards? Yeah. And because there's a lot of criticism about recreations of, because we have partial skeletons, right? And that's what we're working off of. So how similar are they to what people's conception of a dinosaur is?
Well, I think a lot of people's conceptions of dinosaurs images have changed over the past three decades since Jurassic Park came out. But relative to what people picture from Jurassic Park to what they're seeing now and in this series that I just mentioned, I think it's different enough, but not unrecognizable. Mm. I mean, it's not like T-Rex has feathers like a parrot. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the T-Rex is introduced by T-Rex pod swimming to shore.
Oh, okay.
So it's very different from some of the stuff that we've kind of imagined a T-Rex being, you know, doing and all that. And there are some dinosaurs with feathers. You know, that's, it's pretty well known. Mm-hmm. It's pretty well understood. I would say pretty well understood, but like it's often assumed that dinosaurs are extinct, but they're not, because we still have birds. Birds are basically the ancestor, or not the ancestors, the offspring. No, what's the word? What's the opposite of ancestor?
Descendant.
Let me just say it this way: dinosaurs are the opposite of ancestor.
Yeah,
gotcha. Are the ancestors of birds.
And then to get into the more conspiratorial side, Doug, you know, there's vast unexplored areas of the Congo that reportedly have giant lizards.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, hey, you know what I want to see? We won't see this because we don't have the technology to do it.
Yeah.
And I think there is a movie about something like this, but there has to be a planet in some solar system that's in some galaxy that is at its own developmental stage that our planet was 65 million years ago.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a dinosaur out there in the universe.
I mean, if you're in a multi-universe theory, there's got to be a universe where...
I don't even need the multiverse. I'm good with a single universe on this. They're just, you know... It's my version of we just can't be alone in the universe.
We've talked about this before.
I choose to believe that for the same reason I choose to believe in Sasquatch, which is just that it's fun. It's fun to believe that Sasquatch is real.
yeah.
Another notable character, B.D. Wong, who's got a huge list of.
Is that the scientist?
Henry Wu.
Henry Wu.
Yeah, and he's in the second trilogy as well.
Right.
It was like 13 in the original film, he looks
like.
Yeah. He's in the most movies of the six films.
Yeah.
He's in the most films. Because he comes back, I don't know if he's in 2 and 3, but he's in 4, 5, and 6. He is in 4, 5, and 6.
Mm.
So, but he's in Father of the Bride, Jurassic Park. Father Bride Part 2, X-Files. I know him from
I see you scroll past Scooby-Doo.
Probably everyone's in okay. Maybe not.
The substitute in, 2 schools out. He's I somehow in a, read a Scooby-Doo.
He's in Law and Order SVU.
Of course.
Yeah, 230 episodes.
Oh, okay, like, then he's actually in it. Okay.
No, he's actually in Law and Order. No. He's one of the he's one of the
Oh, that's a,
it's a lot of corpses to play.
Yeah, he's a doctor there. He's in Mulan.
Okay, that was good.
Thank you.
he's in Gotham. He plays Dr. Wong in Gotham. He's in so much.
Yeah.
Like, he's Hugo Strange in Gotham.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. He's in the Flash TV series that just ended not too long ago. Yeah. I only know him from this
franchise.
Okay. Samuel L. Jackson is in this movie minimally.
He's got the best line in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And he says it twice.
He's got the best ability to keep a cigarette right at the end of the lips.
Oh, goodness gracious.
While he's talking.
And that's just very filter. Impressive. It's just a filter with some ash on it.
He smoked that down to the core.
Yeah.
And he said it right there.
And twice in the movie, he says the best line in the movie, hold on to your butts. And I know that that's not the line that Samuel Jackson's known for. There's some other flippins that belong in this movie that aren't.
Yeah.
But that's my favorite Samuel Jackson line of all time.
Yeah, something about snakes on a plane, I think.
Yeah. What are all these mother flipping snakes doing on this mother flipping plane?
Yeah. Samuel L. Jackson, I don't think we need to go through his list of movies, but he's in a bunch of stuff.
He's in a ton of top 250 stuff.
Yeah, the last one that's worth noting is Newman.
Yeah, Wayne Knight.
Newman from Seinfeld.
Newman.
Nedry in this movie. He's the one with the shaving cream can. So
yeah.
Yep.
I got some opinions on this guy.
All right, let's have it. The character or the actor?
The character.
Okay.
But I think it should wait till after we get through the stats and stuff.
Okay. All right. I'm almost done with the stats.
IMDb?
That's what's next.
Okay.
I thought you were going to talk about your theories. No. I was waiting. Okay.
I'll wait.
All right. 8.2 out of 10 on the IMDb.
That's right.
It's currently at 144 on the top 250 as we're recording this episode. Do you have the IMDb 250 history?
Yes. Now, with movies that came out before 96, usually they debuted at whatever amount because that's when IMDb top 250 starts, is in 1996. But this actually didn't crack the top 250 until 2012.
Really?
That's right. It got to 218 before falling off again in 2013. It returned to the 250 in March of 2014, and it got a big boost in summer 2015 with the release of Jurassic World, and then it got smaller boosts in 2018 and 2022.
You guys are going to have to fill me in on what this this IMDb 250, I know what IMDb is, but like, how do the rules work for that?
So they've got an algorithm that they work with. You have to have a certain amount of total votes from quote unquote qualified users. That what a qualified user is, they're very, very discreet about, but the best people can really figure out is that it means from North America. And the user base tends to skew male, Caucasian, and so that influences what movies.
I was going to make a joke about that, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. It's just the case, the fact of the matter.
Yeah, yeah.
And so these are the 250 movies with the most ratings and the highest rating. Basically, you're not going to get anything under an 8.0. The movie adjusts daily. When new movies come out, sometimes they're a flash in the pan. Sometimes they're on and they seem to last forever. So with this one specifically, though, it was decades after the top 250 was released that it finally reached the top 250. So this, like a lot of older movies, and by older I just mean before 1996, a lot of them start on the top 250. If they're on today, they started there. This one, for whatever reason, didn't come on until 2012. The highest rank it's ever reached was 143 in May of this past year.
That's because people don't have good taste anymore.
All these young people, they don't know what's a good movie.
There was an Adam Driver movie recently with dinosaurs in it. I can't think of the name of it.
65.
How was it?
I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
Lindsay and I watched it.
What'd you think?
It was entertaining. Like, it was, we talked about this earlier on the show. Like,
yeah.
It's just a film, like, you don't need to know anything before you go into it, and then you leave.
And you don't need to know anything after.
Right. It's just, it was just an entertaining film.
Yeah.
It had some emotion to it. It had action to it. Had some suspense.
Well, I was going to tease Doug that what he means by kids don't know good movies is that good movies have dinosaurs, but he didn't see that one either, so.
Okay. But yeah, no, 65.
Not all good movies do, but, you know.
Yeah, all movies with dinosaurs are good movies, but not all good movies have dinosaurs.
No, I wouldn't even go that far, but sure.
But 65 is okay.
65 is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's okay. It's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. I think Adam Driver's better movie is going to be coming out here shortly. Ferrari.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm really excited to see him in Ferrari. Was that it for the 250 history?
Yep. That's okay. It.
91 on the tomato meter and 91 in the audience of Rotten Tomatoes. So it stands at 91% for both of those.
All right. My hope in humanity has been restored a little bit.
And last couple things here before we get into the meat of this movie. Do you have the budget for this film?
I do. $63 million in 1994. Which is 100.
You think he would have asked for $2 million?
Yeah, just to round it out. A nice solid.
Just to be like, hey, make guys.
Make it divisible by five. Typically, with movie budgets, half of that budget is advertising and marketing. So that would be 134 today because we have 113% inflation in the last 20 years.
That's.
Doug, what causes inflation?
Oh, dude, I was not prepared for that. But it is not rising prices.
It's not corporate greed.
Rising prices are a symptom. It's not corporate greed. There's our pivot. Now we can talk about the movie. Yeah. Corporate greed.
There's our pivot. All right.
One more question before we get to the movie here. Peanut Gallery, what have our Patreon subscribers said about this film?
Yet again, no comments from our Patreon subscribers about their thoughts on the movie. However, 100% of respondents said that they would put it in their top 250.
Nice. Yeah, I think they're wise about that. Yeah.
Oh.
We'll get to that later.
Okay.
Yeah. It's got dinosaurs. It's a good movie.
It's got dinosaurs. It's a good movie. Yeah. All right.
Well, we've made it here.
Let's jump in.
The movie. What do you guys got for biases in this film?
I want to start with Doug because Doug teased their corporate greed. Let's start with that.
Oh, man. Okay, so... So the really basic critique that a lot of people will give is like, this is a movie about corporate greed or the ambition of discovery and, you know, using science to make money and, you know, patent things and all that. Right. And so that's kind of the, like, if there's a message in this film, it's, you know, we should be cautious about how much we think we can do without any sort of parameters, whether, you know, whether it's government or something else. But I'm a little distracted by the fact that there's dinosaurs in this film and that I am a consumer of somebody that there's dinosaurs. I you know, I'm sort of saying that in to be humorous on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's like, come on guys, this is a summer blockbuster.
Yeah.
And yes, the movie does have a message, and I don't want to like downplay that, and we'll talk about that. But in terms of like what I see in the film, I see this film as a person. Hammond doesn't get enough credit, and I realize that it was imposed on him by the by his insurance and the insurance of his investors, right? To be like, hey, we're going to send a guy to this island. You got to prove to me that this is safe, right? At the same time, it's not like he didn't get people's opinions. He was friends with Ian Malcolm. Like, he knew who Ian Malcolm was, and he did end up seeking this out. So there's this tension with the potentially cynical slash potential, you know, or potentially like an endorsement or an endorser with the risks of such an investment. What's really interesting to me is, now that I'm thinking about this, is like, who invests in something like this without actually getting a little bit more specifics, right? Like, no one knew there were dinosaurs until they showed up on this island and they kept it all secret. Like, that in my mind, it's like, who's investing billions of dollars in a dinosaur park, right? You know, without questions. So, but there's this tension in the film, in my mind, with hey, we should be doing this. And, well, should we? Well, I don't know what we can expect. Life finds a way. All that conversation that is taken early in the film around lunch, that's the centerpiece for what we should be thinking about when you watch the rest of the film. Because obviously, I mean, the whole point of the film is that things go wrong, right? And things go wrong that you couldn't expect,
right?
And I don't so much see Hammond as a corporate greed. I just want to market this and make this. He is driven more so by an act of like sheer wonder. And, you know, he says later in the film, I wanted to give some people something that was real. And okay, fine. The critique of that is like, this isn't real. It's a delusion that you could even have this control. But that wasn't, to me, that's an equivocation on, you know, that the writers kind of worked with.
Right.
But I don't see Hammond as fundamentally a bad character just seeking out greed, right? Like, the greedy person is the person who caused all the problems. Mm-hmm. You know, Dennis Nedry, which I guess we'll talk about later. But like, Hammond is the old grandpa. I mean, obviously he's cast in a certain way to be like, and I guess I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure the book kind of depicts him this way as well. It's like, he's a grandfatherly figure who just wants to create this experience for people that creates wonder for them. Right. It's not like, hey, how can I get even more rich? Mm-hmm. It's not like there's nothing there.
Right.
Like, he doesn't want to try again. The lawyer's like, oh, we could charge $10,000 a day and people are going to pay for this. Cause my goodness, it's dinosaurs,
right?
Right, and you know, this is crazy. And he's kind of like, no. This needs to be for everyone. Yeah. I don't see greed in that. To be honest, in fact,
his specific wording is: everyone in the world has the right to enjoy these animals.
Well, yeah. There's that use of the word "right" that's probably wrongly used, but But that's his mentality. Right. Yeah,
yeah. It's interesting because I think I sent you a meme about this a few months ago. Kind of like the left wing, anti-corporatist, socialist leaning, revisionist history view of this movie, which is Hammond as this kind of greedy corporatist, and this movie is a warning of corporatism and capitalism specifically, and the dangers thereof, and I don't see that in this movie at all, right? Like, to start off with, who has all the capital? The investors. The investors are like, oh, a guy just died because you're dinosaurs? Well, we want our lawyer, because of the insurance claim, we want a lawyer to come in with some experts and really make sure that this is a safe investment for us. Well, who's got the capital? Who's got the power? Right? And those guys are cautious.
Yeah.
And then
Yeah.
If anybody here is being reckless, it is Hammond. And Hammond is the one that comes in later and says, everybody has a right to see these dinosaurs. And that's as you pointed out, misuse of rights, you know?
Yeah.
Now, there is, to stay on this topic here, there early on when we see Nedry talking to the guy getting the fake can of aerosol or whatever.
And that character comes back and...
Right, but he...
Dodson.
He says the line...
We got Dodson here.
See, nobody cares.
he mentions how Nedry wouldn't be doing this if Hammond wasn't shorting
him.
So there is that line that Hammond is being a little stingy in areas that maybe he should. And we don't, I know in the book they give more, there's more detail about Nedry.
Right.
But at least in the movie.
All we know is that he's got money problems.
And he's got money problems, and it's due to doing so much for Hammond and not getting compensated for it.
Well,
that's what it's implied.
He has money problems. He thinks that because of his money problems, he should be paid better. Really, it's because of how necessary he is to the operation. He should be paid better. And Hammond says repeatedly throughout the movie, I spared no expense. Well, actually, you did. A guy pivotal to your operation, you didn't pay better. Yep. Now, his money problems are not your problem until they are.
Right. So that there's that argument of Hammond being not fully, you know, being more money-minded, going like...
Yeah. The only expense spared here is...
Extravagance was not a plot, Dennis.
Correct. Terry. That's right.
Correct. Yeah.
But
so I was going to bring that line up earlier, but it fits better with this.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. Yeah. A lot of people like to make, if you're more left leaning, I should say, they want to make this movie out to be like the result of greediness. And I don't know. I don't see it. We're not told specifically where Hammond's riches come from, but I think we're left enough breadcrumbs to conclude it. You know, he talks about how he started a flea circus. That was his first attraction. And then he mentions in a passing line that Jurassic Park's going to be even bigger than the safari he has in, I think, Zimbabwe. I think where he's made his money is in these conservation type projects, you know, in parks.
Yeah, well, and you know, the three of us are not going to, you know, disparage someone like Hammond from actually making a profit on right. things. And if you make a lot of people happen, you end up having a lot of money because you were, you know, leading the effort to make a lot of people mm-hmm. give a lot of people what they want in the market or for tourism or whatever. Yeah. Then okay, fine, so be it. I think the movie does have an element of in terms of its intent to demonstrate that there's corporate greed that could go awry, and that corporate greed can lead us to not think properly
right.
about whether we should be doing something or whether or not there's adverse consequences and so forth. I think the movie, I think it does exist there, but didn't need to exist. Mm. Like that's not key to the storyline.
Right.
It's also not key to like things going wrong. I mean, fine. I you know, your point about spared no expense except with Dennis Nedry, that's a really interesting point, because if you think about it, the storm was uncontrollable, right? So there's a storm that happens, and Dennis Nedry at the same time is, you know, turns off some key security features in the park. You know, you could say that like the one place he spared expense, that's the point of error,
yeah.
right? Like that's where he went wrong. Would Nedry have done this if he had been paid well? I mean, obviously we wouldn't know because it wouldn't be a movie or a book, right? Like it wouldn't make a storyline. Right. But if that's
story.
The case, well, it'd be a very different story if they were. I mean, you know, it's like asking the question, well, why didn't they just use all herbivores?
Right.
Well, that's, you know, because then there's all hardly any risk.
Yeah.
You know, you just have, you know, yeah. So, The question of, you know, it is, or not the question, but to the issue of that's where he spared the expense, you could, in theory, say, well, we just need to make sure that we spend enough money to cover our tracks. Not cover our tracks in like a cover-up kind of way, but like to, you know, mitigate risk even more, right? And I don't know. I have the spirit of, I can understand why somebody... In, say, for example, Jurassic World. I forget the guy's name. He's the Indian guy who owns Jurassic World or runs it or whatever.
Is this the InGen guy? No.
InGen?
No.
No, yeah.
Biosyn.
InGen, meaning the company, right. the tech company.
That's Dodson. The bio same tech character company. From the first movie.
No, but I'm talking to, yeah, no, I'm talking about in Jurassic World. I'm talking about the he's an Indian actor.
He dies in the helicopter.
He's the guy who tried to fly the helicopter in the first in Jurassic World. He wanted to build this park, and I'll be honest, I would want to rebuild the park. Okay, so like, you know, at the end, Hammond, Sam Neill's character, Alan Grant, they rush to the Jeep. They're racing away toward the helicopters. It's the end of the movie, very end of the movie, last 3 minutes. And he goes, after further consideration, I've decided not to endorse your park. And then Hammond says, so have I.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, fine. But yeah, like a year later, I would still be like mulling over like, well, how could I have done this better? Because there is something about the spirit of entrepreneurship, not just that, but the spirit of innovation and the spirit of coming to things that create wonder and awe for people are worth attempting. And, you know, we're sitting here 30 years later on this movie, and we're still talking about the kinds of things that people always talk about, which is how could we have done things better?
Yeah.
Right. And like, unfortunately, they haven't asked that question in the movie making part of the Jurassic, you know, franchise. But, you know, it's like, how can we make this better? No, we're just going to be like, how can we sell movie tickets, right? And merchandise and so forth. Although, again, Jurassic World was fine. There was that. It was fine. So, anyway, I don't know. I was rambling on a little bit, but I do understand the impulse to basically say, hey, we should try to do something that gives people awe and wonder. Yeah. And I think there is enough in our world now, to wax eloquent here for a second, there's enough in the world now that we do not take time to marvel at. And I think people need to do that more. Mm. And, you know, so some of it requires, and you can marvel at a lot of things. You can marvel at, you know, going outside, touching grass, seeing a beautiful landscape. You can marvel at going to the Grand Canyon. Like, I was at the Grand Canyon for the first time last year, and I was thoroughly expecting to be disappointed because of all the hype. I was not. And I know some people might be. Like, some people might go there and be like, okay, this is really beautiful, but like, what the heck is the big deal that everyone else says, right? So it just depends. Obviously, we're going to have different experiences.
It's just a big hole in the ground.
It's a big scratch in the ground, you know, done by some large alien or something. It's like, well, on Mars, there's a bigger canyon.
An even bigger flood.
Elon. Yeah. But you can marvel at things that are more of nature, or you can marvel at things that humans do, right? Yeah. Like, you can marvel at skyscrapers. I think I just read, I saw this meme. I think it was more of a meme, but it was reporting that there's this like diamond crusted skyscraper that's going to go up in the UAE. And it's just like, really? Like, really? Okay, fine. Like, engineering feats, right? You know, the types of glass that they use in certain of the major flagship Apple stores around this in cities around the world. It's like, no one makes glass building structures that way, right? Or just even simple things like technology working and also integrating into our lives in a way that doesn't make us fiddle with the technology. It just works.
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of things, or just beautiful technology. I'm sure you've seen a beautiful guitar or a beautiful set of headphones or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
We can marvel at things in life. And I think a lot of people are underwhelmed. And I think that's a big problem, because there's so much in the world to be upset about. There's so much to the world to that's ho-hum, but there are so many things in the world that if we just have the right outlook, we can marvel at what's happening.
I think that's very in line with a lot of the writings of G.K. Chesterton, you know, talking about just how even in his day, you know, practically 100 years ago, people just, you know, not people ignoring the whimsy and magic that's all around them. And they didn't have the constant distraction of screens, and they were even, you know, bored with what was going on. And then he looked for the magical, he looked for the whimsical, the marvelous.
If there's one critique of modern capitalism that I have a very pinch of empathy for. It is that a highly affluent society results in what we just discussed, or could more or less result in what we just discussed. Now, that's not to say that in pre-capitalist societies where there was, you know, relative affluence, that boredom didn't happen and that people were just, oh my goodness, I'm, you know, like the farmer in the field who like labored from morning till night and almost, you know, barely feeds his family, you know, pre-capitalist days and whatever. It's not like he was standing there in the field just like, oh man, I'm so glad that I can just sit here and enjoy these fields and these mountains that are surrounding me, or these valleys that are, that I can look out upon, and they can just like, or he can, he can make, he can marvel at the tools he's using because, you know, the blacksmith down the road just made it beautiful or whatever. Like, he wasn't doing the kinds of things that I just described per se, but that doesn't mean that they weren't appreciative of the land. It's not an either or per se, in my mind. But there is something to be said of when you have a lot and when everything is satiated, it is possible. And it is, no, I wouldn't even say possible. It's probably not unusual to have people who are bored.
Yeah.
And who are underwhelmed by life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to tie that into scripture, God tells the Israelites as they're coming out of Egypt, hey, you know, in generations to come, when everything's real nice for you guys, don't forget how you got there. Don't think that you did this on your own.
Yep.
And I think that we're all prone to that, even within our own lifetime, to say, yeah, all the comforts I have are because of how excellent I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. No additional comments.
I think I said what I needed to on that one.
Jeff, any thoughts?
Not to add to that conversation. No, right. That was good.
All right. Moving on to another comment then here. This is one of my favorite lines in the movie. And there's a conversation leading up to it. And it's actually one of the lines in our opening title sequence, our theme song. So Ian Malcolm says, John, the kind of control you're attempting here is, it's not impossible. It's not possible. If there's one thing that the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, expands to new places, and crashes through barriers. Painfully, perhaps, even dangerously. But, well, there it is. And John Hammond says, there it is, and looks away. Henry Wu says, you're implying that a group composed entirely of females will breed? And Ian Malcolm says, no, I'm simply saying that life finds a way. I think this is really interesting, and this is foreshadowed too, when what's his name? They're on the
Grant. Sorry, are you talking about Grant?
Yeah, in the helicopter.
Well, I don't know when you're referring to. Where my mind jumped was when he discovered the
eggs. Oh, okay. So that's actually like that foreshadows Grant with the eggs, but actually this whole thing is foreshadowed by Grant in the helicopter. So when they're in the helicopter, they experience some turbulence. Everybody buckles in. Grant goes to buckle in, but he's got two female ends of the seatbelt buckle, and so he ties them together.
Oh my word! I can't believe that I'd never put that together. That's a
so he found a way, and I find that.
did you come up with that, or did you like?
I probably saw that somewhere.
Oh my word! I don't know. In all of my like reading about stuff, like I actually did a little bit of like research on like Jurassic Park and philosophy and like what are people saying about how all that never I just thought of it as he had the two same ends of the seatbelt, which is
and the they're same both thing, female right? ends like, specifically
I get it now.
I don't know where I saw that. That's if crazy. I saw that, I don't think that's an original thought, Doug. I'm not that smart.
I also saw that somewhere.
Okay,
doing research for this,
definitely not an original thought.
That's
but I didn't that wasn't something I picked up on until this time studying this movie.
Yeah.
So it's a very small, subtle detail, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. That's a very spiel. Is that in the book? Do you remember offhand?
I don't know if that's the kind of thing that you per se show in a book like that. Like that's a different technique. Sure. I'm going to go read the book again. I thought about reading it last week, and I was like, oh, I got these other books I got to read.
And you do a lot of reading.
So I read a lot, yeah.
Linked below where you can read for yourself Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. And let us know in the comments, does that scene happen? So, yeah, that kind of, for me, this whole chaos theory, life finds a way type thing, it kind of harkens back to Robert P. Murphy wrote a book called Chaos, or he compiled some of his essays into a book called Chaos Theory. And it's about how the market can provide solutions to complex problems. Pretty interesting way. And basically it's, you know, as Ian Malcolm says, life finding a way. By having unregulated attempts at something, what's the line? A thousand monkeys at keyboards given an infinite amount of time will eventually create Shakespeare. If you have enough attempts at something, you'll find an option that works. And for me, this is kind of like poking the holes in hubris, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, we know that we're going to make this work because we wrote this rule and that rule is perfect. And given enough time, someone's going to find a hole in that rule.
Well, and they even illustrate that early on in the movie when Muldoon was explaining how the velociraptors mm-hmm. behave, testing the fence systematically. Yeah. And they had a hierarchy, and the alpha female, I guess, in mm-hmm. this case, had them testing the system, testing the fence, the electrified fence is the word I'm looking for. They had them testing that systematically.
Yeah.
And they will find a way. Yeah. I mean, look, you can just look outside at a sidewalk and find life finding a way in between the cracks. Oh, and yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody lay concrete sidewalks, but it's not thin.
Right.
Right. It, you know, it gets through there. And, you know, we've all been on those really neat hikes where there's like rocks and like boulders and stuff. And then like all of a sudden there's just like one tree that's been there for 35 years sticking out between two boulders. And you're like, where on earth does it find soil and water to collect for this? To grow, right? And, you know, so, yeah, life finds a way.
Did you add that in there on purpose? It was the perfect Ian Malcolm reference. It was great.
Yeah.
There's also, and you've probably seen this, Doug, it was this college campus, and they put a sidewalk in. And the sidewalk is curvy through this section. And you look at the grass, though, and the grass is really worn out in a straight line. Because even though the sidewalk is a specific way, this is the way you have to take.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, no, this is a shorter cut. I don't care if it's going to be muddy some parts of the year.
Yeah.
This is the way I'm going. And I don't know. To some degree, that's entrepreneurialism. And it's just this, life's going to find a way. It's going to do the thing that you don't expect. It's going to do the thing that you don't want it to do oftentimes.
Do you think you'd find that in Nordic countries where they're pretty more, or Japan? Where, like, if they have like a curved sidewalk, I don't think Japanese people would do that. I think that's an American thing or a Western civilization.
It might
thing.
Be.
I have a friend who spent 11 years in Japan. I'll ask him. He's you a close should. Friend of mine.
If that's a uniquely American thing,
I will ask him.
Then that is the thing that I love most about Americans.
We walk in straight lines.
that we walk
in straight lines.
When we're told exactly. to be walking in straight lines.
I'm glad you understood what I was trying to say there, Jeff.
Got it. Yeah.
What else you got, Jeff? You got anything?
Well, just within that topic, like I watch a specific YouTube channel about reptiles. it fascinates me.
Linked below.
And yeah, we can post one of the videos there.
What's the name of the channel?
Snake Bites. Or it's Brian Barchek. They're based out of Michigan. He has a couple zoos and stuff like, but just it's educational, it's funny, it's good content. Like but he has an anaconda that reproduces without a mate. And I know plants do this, but like watching him talk about how he has this anaconda that just all of a sudden gave birth, and it's kept in a cage by itself. Like, he doesn't mate it. He breeds snakes for a living. This one was not bred. It's like, because he tracks all that.
Yeah.
It's just I didn't realize till
how do you So having a snake and breeding a snake are the same thing in this case.
For some
literally
snake.
In this case.
For some snakes. Yeah. And I didn't know this, but I didn't know there were animals that can breed without a mate.
Yeah.
Or can reproduce without a mate.
Yeah.
And so, like, he had a live clutch of snake babies from a snake that never made it. And so watching that YouTube channel and then going back to watching this movie then for this episode of the podcast, I'm like, okay, so it is logic. Like, it can happen in nature that animals can continue life.
Yeah, that wasn't just a film.
I just never put much thought into it. I was like, okay, so I've seen it in reality, and I've now seen it in a fictional movie. Yeah, life does find a way.
Yeah.
And it's a small thing just to add to this conversation, but I found that very fascinating. Shout out to Brian Barczyk.
In the movie, he references an African frog, but there's actually North American frogs that do the same thing. All right.
Yeah.
I want to.
There's also species of plants.
Correct. Yeah. And I was familiar with the plants
I have to preface the following.
Asexual.
I have to preface the following because of how much he does get wrong. Alex Jones years ago said they're turning the frogs gay. What he was talking about was there's chemicals in the water that's castrating frogs. And so frogs are actually becoming transgender in order to mate. And this is actually proven to be true. The concern he was raising is, if this is what's happening to frogs from the chemicals in the water, what can these chemicals be doing to humans? Now, the way he went about raising awareness for this, I think, was entirely useless. But it does raise some interesting questions, you know? With most things,
I'm not going to.
With
go
most things,
road.
Alex Jones, the safest response is no comment. All right. Any more on this topic before we move on?
That was it for that topic.
Well, I have a different topic I want to bring up is the idea of concentrated power. If you think about the way in which Hammond, you know, organized this, I mean, you could say that this is one thing of like, okay, we've got this island, we have to control it, and it's a small team of people that are sort of in charge. But the concept of putting the entire park security system in the hands of one person who you've underpaid, or who thinks he's underpaid, even if you may not have underpaid him. Maybe he was paid really well and he just didn't think so, right? That didn't matter, right? As long as he thought he was underpaid, he had perverse incentives. So you've concentrated power, right? And then you also have, there was another piece of concentrated, with Henry Wu, there was one scientist, right, who is sort of in charge of how do we do this? And again, I know there was a team of things. Nedry was for scientists, but Nedry was the security slash programmer. Yep. The thing is, though, the other... the other members of the team, they weren't like brought in on the security detail type stuff, right? And so this is just, you know, one example where when one person is in charge of a lot, even if they're really, you know, a technological genius or whatever, I mean, it seems like Nedry clearly was able to do, you know, a lot. It's futile. It's not going to work. And what happens when that fails? Right. So the point of failure, I mean, obviously there was many points of failure, but one of the big points of failure that made the movie's plot go was that the security system went out because of one person and because of their malice or not quite incompetence. Right. He was very competent in making sure that he could control everything. Like they had to reboot the whole system just to get around his, you know, there was no loophole. Rebooting the system was a loophole. So the prospect of rebooting a system to get rid of concentrated power is a very appealing thought to me.
Yeah.
I never thought about that. The fact that like everything relied on one guy versus having a large facility like that, but having one person that's has the password or has the code to, usually there'd be a chain of command or a multiple people that had the same information to work different shifts.
Right.
Yeah.
In a lot of corporate environments, they refer to that as siloing, you know, the siloing of knowledge within a specific department or team or individual.
Well, I mean, 9/11, the intelligence community in 9/11, the failure to prevent 9/11 from happening was often blamed on the idea of siloing between agencies.
Right.
Not that I'm in favor of not siloing that, but that's a whole different conversation. But that is a risk. I mean, whether or not we... think that's
well I don't think I've ever heard it articulated that siloing is also centralization, and you're absolutely right. I've just never looked at it that way. And you know, I've always when I look at this movie and centralization of power, I look at it as John Hammond, you know, because he controls where the investor money goes.
Yeah,
but you're right also that they centralize all the tech security in one man who in his opinion, regardless of what he was paid, in his opinion, he was underpaid.
Yeah.
I heard an episode of The Way the World Works, which is Connor Boyack, creator of the Tuttle Twins. He's got a family-friendly podcast, and it was talking about asking for raises. And one of the things was, if the amount of money that it's going to cost an employer to replace you and train the next guy is more per year than what you're asking for in a raise, you'll probably get that raise. And so based on what Nedry's skills were, I think what we really see here, this whole movie is a conversation about hubris. And not this isn't to say that Nedry is a good guy, but I think Hammond underestimated the value that Nedry brought to the operation and the cost to replace him.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he figured out what the cost mm-hmm. was. And it was pretty costly. I mean, I don't think the moral of the story is necessarily pay all your people really well.
No.
Although that is potentially, it. It could be that he was literally the only person for the job. It could be, a number of other sure. things. But yeah. No, anyway, your comments are right.
Nedry's definitely the one character out of this whole series that I'm like, I could use more from. Like we talked about it with
Fargo.
With Fargo. Like just like maybe I'd have a different opinion about this character if I just knew a little bit more of his motives.
I want an eight-episode backstory on Nedry specifically.
I really, and honestly, I'd watch it. I'd be into that. I feel like there could be more to him that's just alluded.
I'm going to talk.
Is that actor still alive?
I believe he is.
Yeah. Wayne Knight, yeah. Yeah, he's alive.
Surprisingly.
Yeah.
Newman.
All right, I've got one. This might not go anywhere, but this is something that stuck out to me. So they lowered that cow into the raptor. In my notes, I wrote it as CAFO, confined animal feeding operation. In modern agriculture, you take all these cows that should be out grazing and you put them in a very tight area and you kind of strip away everything about them that makes their behavior cow-like and you force feed them in these troughs. And then you pump them full of antibiotics because that close that close habitation is prone to make them sick. And then in human fecal matter, we detect bovine pharmaceutical products because we eat that and poop it out. So we have
you do.
I don't.
if you have the opportunity to eat grass fed beef, I commend you, sir.
Literally the only beef I sorry.
No,
that's the only beef I eat.
For the vast majority of Americans, anyway, the protein that they eat and consume comes.
Costco has relatively inexpensive meat that's grass fed. Like just for everybody's reference here, it is one thing that I've seen. Sorry,
this is great.
Slight rabbit hole or tangent is like over the past 10 to 15 years, the cost of organic and grass fed and all that has gone down significantly. I don't think people realize that.
I would caution though, the price of organic food has gone down since the federal government defined what organic is. And so I'm suspicious once again of what is organic. But Joel Salatin is one of my favorite agricultural authors. And he talks about the cowness of a cow. And he runs this grass-fed operation where everything about it is like, I want the pig to be the most like a pig. I want the chickens to live a life that is most exemplary of what a chicken's life should be like. And then And in his own words, he says, if it weren't for people like me, I'd be a vegan, right? If I couldn't conceive this way of giving the most, not humanity, but cowmanity to a cow, I wouldn't want to eat that cow.
It's the bovinity. Yeah.
There you go, bovinity.
I like that.
And then later we get the line from Grant. A T-Rex doesn't want to be fed. It wants to hunt. You can't just suppress 65 million years of gut instinct. And that's part also the undoing of Jurassic Park, is that they've got all these carnivores that they've been force-feeding in contained lots, and these animals want to hunt. And when we take our quote-unquote scientific approach, these animals end up getting what I can't remember the term for it. Zookosis is the word. So if you've ever been to a zoo, dog, where you see like the tiger or the lion pacing back and front right at the edge of its habitat,
Yeah.
So that is a result of the animal's anxiety and stress of not being in a territory big enough for what it's made for. And the word they give that is zoocosis. Elephants tend to sway back and forth. Carnivores like lions and tigers tend to pace back and forth. And I think that, you know, kind of what this movie's touching on here and what Joel Salatin's talking about as well is that animals have an intended function. God created them with a purpose. And when we strip them of that purpose, it dramatically affects their quality of life. And then as Joel Salatin points out, not just the quality of life, but their quality of taste. A cow that is allowed to be a cow tastes a whole lot better than one that's force-fed corn on pavement. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thought that comes to my mind is domestication.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that, you know, in my mind right now, I'm picturing the park with the fences going, you know, with the fences still activated, right? And everything's safe. And it's like, okay, we've kept the wild animals at bay. We've kept them domesticated. Well, maybe not domesticated, but they're domesticated in our minds, right? They're behind, they're safe, right? And the idea that we should play with nature is a very prominent theme in the film. And it's obviously down, you know, it's chastised, right? Like, it's the whole point of the film is don't mess with nature. It's really wild out there. It don't mess with things that you don't understand. What strikes me as a little ironic is that critique typically comes from the left.
Yep.
And they're the same people that don't quite realize how well we have domesticated the environment to suit and the climate to suit human compatibility. And they want to, you know, all these, the environmentalists that are the sort of more, sometimes people say like the more crunchy type of like, well, we just need to get back to the way nature was and yada, yada, yada. It's like, do you really not understand that that's not safe either? Right. Like, yeah, there's trade-offs obviously involved in what we're doing. Yeah. And okay, fine. Maybe the CO2 levels are rising. Okay, well, we'll manage that, we hope. But it's not just like a zero sum where it's like, well, we did all this Industrial Revolution thing and man, we shouldn't have. No, that's not the alternative, right? So anyway, there's a little bit of irony there in that the film that would, you know, typically from the left, I don't think Spielberg's an alt-right, you know, icon, right? So that typically comes from the left is going to be like, oh, well, we need to be, you know, we need to respect nature. And that's true. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that critique per se, but on the other hand, it's like, hey, you won't survive in nature, Mr. Protester, protesting the environment, you know, with an iPhone and like really nice, you know, protection in the city. Like, yeah, I don't have much time for people like that.
What's your guys' opinions about just the ethical implications of zoos in general? I was at a zoo last week or 2 weeks ago.
I also was.
Like, and like, I would say I'm pro zoo.
I am.
But just in general, like, my wife and I were at Cleveland Zoo, to be specific, and I forget what exhibit it was, but there were a couple times where I'm just like, I acknowledge the fact that, like, this feels wrong.
Right.
But then there's other times where I'm like, they're doing this. This is for science, this is to learn this, like I can justify it in some, and then there's some I'm like, this doesn't feel right. Like, I'm always back and forth when it comes to zoos, and it's because it's not necessarily domestication of animals, but
it's not domestication at all.
It is the pulling from their natural habitat and shrinking it and just going all eyes on you and you're confined. Like, But at the same time, it does further science. It does further our experience. It does further our knowledge about them.
Yeah. So
we can gain stuff from it. It educates the populace. But at the same time, are there negative effects from zoos?
Yes, there are negative effects, but those are called trade-offs for other positive effects. I mean, we should know this, right? Like, there's a trade-off. You could not do zoos whatsoever, and now you have a slightly less educated and uninitiated populace of people who think they understand what a tiger is, but they don't. They've never even seen one because they're not from North America, at least that I'm aware of. I think the thing with zoos, though, is like the part that makes us feel a little icky about it is that it's got that amusement park feel.
Yeah.
Maybe not the wow factor of a roller coaster per se or a thrill ride, but like it's got that amusement park feel. You're there if you're there with your kids. When I took my kids to the zoo, I think we've been there twice to the Philadelphia Zoo. When I took my kids to the zoo, they were younger. There were strollers involved. There was standing and throwing food at certain types of animals. There was just this like observe what's happening. And I think generally there's nothing really wrong with that per se, but I think that gives us that sort of icky feel of like, well, why is that animal just trapped in this, you know, 1 acre environment and it could just have thousands of acres. Well, the alternate world is that animal might not even live.
Right.
we took in a cat a few years ago, 7 years ago. And we were talking about the, like, you know, the care of the cat and whatever. And there was a point at which I was like, no, hold on. If we hadn't taken her in, she'd be dead. Yeah. Like she can survive these environments. It's not like we mistreated our cat at all. We didn't at all.
You fired it out of a cannon, like, look, maybe twice. I said, you fired it out of a cannon, maybe twice.
Maybe.
Oh man. Yeah. That'd be great. Maybe, maybe twice. The second one, it was a misfire. I don't even remember. Zoos. I think part of the idea of zoos is that these zoos have become more responsible.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And they've become a little bit more conservation minded. They rotate the animals to other habitats. I actually took my daughters to a wolf preserve a couple months ago. Cool. And there were like six wolves. And they had plenty of space, and they were very clear that the people who ran it, they were very clear that these are wild animals, and yes, we could get in the cage with them. But there's no illusion in their minds that they would not dogs. You know, they're similar in many respects. I mean, you can watch a wolf's behavior, it's very dog-like. So especially depending on what kind of dog you have. I mean, if you have a Chihuahua, maybe not, but if you have any sort of shepherd or, you know, those kinds of the dogs that kind of resemble a wolf more so, you can tell they're just, it's the same.
Like an Irish wolfhound.
So, I can't picture.
What it looks like a wolf.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's domesticated, but it looks like a wolf.
Yeah. Oh. So as long as we realize that these aren't necessarily domesticated, that these are just encaged or whatever. Yeah. I think if there's any industry at all that's cognizant of care of animals and environmental protection and stewardship, it's going to be zoos. It's going to be people in that realm. Right. I mean, some of them might be, you know, I don't think of zoo owners or zoo managers as particularly right wing.
I was the one that brought up Zoocosis, and I thought that I was seeing Zoocosis recently. For my wife's birthday, we went to the Akron Zoo, and the tiger was pacing back and forth really close to the glass, which typically is Zoocosis. And it was looking at the audience, and so I was like, man, it just wants to eat me more than anything. And then I turned around, and I saw lazing in the sun a female tiger. And I was like, oh, this male tiger has entirely different things on its mind. It was just separated by habitat from a female tiger.
Yeah.
And so that pacing was entirely different. Zoos have come a long, long way. About 100 years ago, even, we had human zoos in America where people from different cultures were kept in basically captivity and on display. And zoos have come a very, very long way. They're exclusively animals now, and I can't think of his name, but he's based out of Columbus. He's passed now. The Columbus Zoo really kind of championed this idea of zoo habitats need to be, they need to allow the animal to really be itself and not be stressed and anxious and all these other things. Zookeepers very much have the care and needs of those animals at heart, but with the carnivores specifically in Jurassic Park, I don't think that was as well there.
Jack Hanna.
Jack Hanna. Yes, that's his name.
Yep.
So as much as I was the one that brought up zoocosis and needs of animals, right. Like I've got a year long subscription to the Akron Zoo.
Yeah.
I go all the time.
That was more of a devil's advocate question.
I am
pro zoo and stuff, but
I'm the most right wing person here. I've got to maintain that position.
On the flip side though, I had an issue with this even before it got out of hand, but like the Shamu situation.
Oh yeah.
That was always one that felt wrong. And I don't think you can ever justify that. Like,
I'm against Shamu. I prefer the real Mu.
There are families of killer whales, orcas that I just gloss over it. Just like that are literally like, and like.
It was a whale of a joke. Gosh, man.
Thank Stop you. It, actually, it was an orca of a joke.
Dad jokes.
But yeah, I'm glad that doesn't happen anymore. To have something that big that small of a container.
Yeah.
Like,
it still happens, but in North America, it doesn't.
Where else? I mean, SeaWorld does not have any more Shamus.
No, but the world's a very large place.
Right, but...
And not all cultures share our sympathies with animals.
Prove it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Shamu is the other one that I think about.
Yeah, Shamu is a great example of that, yeah.
I'm glad they don't do that anymore.
Free Willy.
Yeah, free him.
Free him.
Free him.
Doug, any final?
Somehow we were talking about Jurassic Park and now we're like Free Willy.
No, this is about orcas now. Doug, any additional thoughts about zoo culture or agriculture and as it applies to Jurassic Park?
I don't know if I know much about zoo culture and agriculture per se, so I don't know if I'll particularly have comments about that. So
yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. That's one that I had in my notes here, and I was like, this is probably like a dud. But, you know, I just want to...
Well, the closest thing to agriculture I have experience with is there are farm stands around where I live because there's farmers where I live, and I don't farm. And, I mean, I can plant things, and I know how they grow. And
you're in Amish country.
I don't.
And the Amish aren't certified USDA and FDA organic, but they are more similar to organic principles prior to the USDA organic label than organic is. Mm-hmm. And if you're at a farmer's market, if something says locally grown or locally sourced, that's far more likely to be what organic used to be. You commented.
Yeah, genuinely.
Yeah, you commented on how organic come down in price. And a lot of that is just due to the USDA organic label.
Recategorization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It used to be that if you wanted to be organic by farmer standards, you had to have a certain amount of buffer zone between your farm and the next farm that had pesticides. Mm-hmm. The USDA also has those, but they're much smaller. For some people, that's a negligible difference, and it's science evidenced and all that stuff. But for other people, they say no, that's not enough. I tend to. Even though what I buy at the grocery store isn't as clean and organic as I'd like it to be, I do tend to lean towards more the kookier side of organic than the USDA side.
Well, I guess you can't get too organic.
I mean, it used to be real kooky too, like people saying, you know, it's not really organic unless you bury a packed cow hoof during a full moon in the middle of a field. That's real organic.
I'll eat that. Oh, yeah.
It's like unless you raise the cow yourself and slaughter yourself and, you know, could monitor it all times to make sure that it didn't eat any dirt or didn't eat a scrap of hot dog that your kid left on the ground.
Doug, you and I are familiar enough with libertarian circles to know that the litmus tests never run dry.
Oh, that's very true. That is very true.
Any additional things, or should we get into wrap up?
We hit all the main quotes that I had.
Okay.
Yeah. Evolution, cloning.
I got one last one here. Doug, do you have any more before I get my last one here?
I don't.
This one's a longer conversation. This is between Ian Malcolm and Hammond. Malcolm says, "I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. To read what others have done." You took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew it, you've patented it, packaged it, and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. Hammond says, I don't think you've given us due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody has ever done. Yeah, yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied over whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. Hammond says, if I were to create a flock of condors on this island, you wouldn't have anything to say. This isn't some species that was obliterated by deforestation or the building of a dam. Dinosaurs had their shot, and nature selected them for extinction. Hammond says, I simply don't understand this kind of Luddite attitude, especially from a scientist. How can we stand in the light of discovery and not act? Malcolm says, what's so great about discovery? It's a violent, penetrative act that scars what it explores. What you call discovery, I call the rape of the natural world. For me here, this was a pivot point where Malcolm becomes a very unlikable character, in my opinion. Because very suddenly, he goes from nature finds a way, life finds a way, to your entrepreneurial spirit, which is still life finding a way, must be stopped. And he also shifts goalposts in this argument a lot, you know? And,
yeah.
And I found him to be very unlikable in this conversation. I think Hammond's points are incredibly valid. You know, if I was to create a flock of condors on this island, you wouldn't have anything to say about it. I also think that Malcolm, though, has the most succinct explanation of hubris I've ever heard. You were so preoccupied over whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think if you should. Like, that's like the perfect summary of hubris, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's probably the only solid critique in that monologue or that dialogue that's happening there. Like, when he was like, it didn't require any discipline to attain it. I'm like, well, no. What do you think right. they were doing? That this wasn't like a software program that they
and also all modern science is built on the shoulders of previous scientists.
Pirated. Yeah, that kind of is kind of like a BS line in my mind. Like, it's not like they pirated some sort of software and are selling, you know, there's not like a Chinese it's knockoff the Facebook of IP story. Or
patents
right?
and
like,
intellectual property aside.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, sure. But like he defends him and defends himself and says, you know, I think you misunderstand what we've done here. And then you're right. He pivots. He shifts the goalposts. I'm like, well, okay, fine. You know, and maybe that's just a seeding of the ground there. But then he's like, well, you should, you know, you're preoccupied with whether you could and not whether you should. And it's like, well, I see. This is where I get to the like, yeah. So, like. That's what you're here for. I am. It's not my job, and I would be careful here, but it's not my job to think about whether or not I should. That's the job of people I'm hiring, like you and bringing here. Now, again, this is after the fact. He's already created the dinosaurs and all that. So clearly there's that going on. But there are people, I mean, from a personal perspective, we all have to, you know, think about how we grow in wisdom and grow in as Christians in our discipleship. And we can't just sort of outsource everything. Right. Like characters and behaviors are not things that we can outsource. We have to become whole human beings. And so as individuals, we should think about whether or not we should do something, even if we could. At the same time, that doesn't mean you can't nurture the, we should try to do this, right? Or we can do this. Let's see what we can get away with, or let's see what we can make out of this, right? Not get away with. And so you can personally have that ethos of like, yes, that's good advice for you personally. But sometimes when you coordinate things and innovate and cooperate in the environment in the market and so forth, it's like, you know what? You need to hire, what do they call them? A red team, I think. In like lawyer teams, I learned this from the newsroom, the show, the newsroom, they have something called a red team, which is basically like, find all the flaws in this story, because this story could go completely wrong. You know, imagine if, we see this recently in the news with Israel Hamas. There are, you know, the New York Times is quick to rush to judgment on who bombed what. Oh, it turned out that wasn't it. And so for certain stories and things in this show that I was watching, so you can have your own red team where you vet the stories and you try to like figure out what could go wrong. And I think generally speaking, humanity is looking at science more. They're using ethics to think more and more about science. I mean, one of the reasons that Elon Musk helped found OpenAI was so that it is because he actually didn't trust Jeff Bezos and Larry Page, a guy from Oracle, with their attempts at AI. He was like, "Yeah, this is a bigger animal. I don't trust you. We need to have one that's going to have parameters in place that is human centric and will never, you know, basically have sort of a catch, so to speak, that it will never harm humans or something like that." And so there are, I mean, the market is a good, you know, enveloper of this. I mean, if you think about it, the story of how Jurassic Park, the first movie at least, failed is the market, if you will, it was a very loose sense, is essentially telling Hammond, "Nope, you shouldn't." That's who said you shouldn't. I mean, at what point should he have said, "Nah, we shouldn't do this"? Maybe he didn't know. Maybe it wasn't a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think that he shouldn't have said no until the funding was pulled. But the insurance says, "Hey, there's a problem here." That's a red flag for the investors. But if the experts come through and say, "Hey, actually, this is all right," he should keep going. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a more sophisticated way of saying what I just said.
Oh, thank you.
Like, yeah, that's your, well, I'm, so there's that. I mean, I don't know if necessarily money, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's possible for him to be like, "You know what? The money's here. We can make money on this. It's just not right." You know, for whatever reason. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Maybe possibly he could have come up with a different option, you know, and that's what investors are for. Again, back to my one original comment early on, it's like, well, why didn't they know? But like, you know, again, you wouldn't have a movie, you wouldn't have a book, you wouldn't have a storyline if it were just all herbivores. But, you know, imagine if all we did was bring back herbivores, dinosaurs. What could possibly go wrong?
Not enough salads for the rest of us.
Yeah, there's what could go wrong.
The salad shortage.
It's a very different movie.
Oh, man.
We all have fiber issues because there's not enough dietary fiber. Anyways, I'm not a scientist. So. That's where my mind went, was dietary stuff.
Yeah.
I think no, with my stomach.
Good. That's
here,
a good. You were
some keen insights.
Yeah.
Thinking holistically.
Anywho.
Wrap up questions.
Let's do this. All right. Here we go. First question around the table here. Would you recommend this film?
Without hesitation.
I would.
I would also. It's a great movie.
It's great.
It's entertaining. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. The music's great.
Incredible.
The music's great. Yeah.
And also the foreshadowing that you can watch dozens of times before picking up.
Right.
As Doug showed us.
Yeah. How many times did I not notice the female seatbelts?
I think that's a beautiful part of that. There's a depth to this film that like every time you rewatch it, there's a newness to it. There's a freshness to it. I love it. That makes a good movie.
I would say all the worldview and like truth claims are in the first half.
Yeah.
The second half is just a
all action.
Action monster, horror movie.
Yeah.
Now, flash of flick.
And I will say, like, I would also, and we're not going to talk about any of the other five, but just like, I would also recommend the other five too. Like, I think as a whole series, there's movies that stand out in the whole series, but they're all worth the watch. I would definitely watch them all too. I feel like saying that. You guys don't have to.
If you're somebody that just wants to, like, get the basics of the movie and kind of get what the franchise is about, watch the first one from both trilogies.
Absolutely. This one stands alone.
Yeah.
Like, you could watch this and not have the other ones and then be just fine. Yeah. But the other ones are entertaining.
Different.
They hit a little differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they hit on a lot of the same topics of ethics. Even, you know, in the
hubris.
The movie five, there's, you know, they go into more of the, like, we can make money on these dinosaurs. We can sell them. Like there's a lot more commercialism and, right.
Modified
so, like,
them, yeah.
So there's they hit more topics that are worth discussing.
Right.
But just not IMDb top 250 worth.
No.
So
I will say that my third ranking on all of those is that it would be the first movie. and then the Jurassic World. So Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, and then Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which is the second of movie five, if you will. I thought it was better than everybody gave it credit for, even though it was kind of two movies in one, in terms of two storylines in a way. But yeah, that's recommended.
I liked in movie six has all the original cast, Laura Dern, Sam, they're all back. Like,
it's like in that,
it was more than just fan service too. Like they did it in a way that felt comfortable. So that was probably my biggest thing with that. That was my favorite part of this movie six was having the new cast and the original cast together.
Since we're commenting most of the outside movie. This first Jurassic Park, I would say the sixth, it reunites the old cast and the new cast. But introduces a bunch of new cast.
Correct.
And that just muddies it.
Right. And there is one cast member. Okay. So in the second movie, in Lost World, you find out that Jeff Goldblum's character has a daughter.
Actually, he mentions it in the first movie.
Right. But you meet her.
Yeah.
And she's African American.
Yeah.
When we met the African American girl in the sixth movie, I just assumed that, when these two cross paths, they're going to, like, Jeff Goldblum's character was like, "Oh, that's my daughter."
Right.
Like, we were just waiting for them to connect more of these storylines, and that never happened. And I'm just like,
"Nope, I'm related."
Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
When Lindsay and I were watching the sixth movie,
there's more than one black woman in this franchise.
With the way that franchise movies do this, though, like you just expect that they're going to connect as many things as possible. So my brain was wired to go, "He's got a black daughter." They're not crossing paths yet.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, so like just that was just one of the things like. It didn't ruin the movie for me, but I was like, I was expecting something different because of the way movies are done. Anyways, okay. This movie is, let me double check here. This movie is PG-13. Would you guys change the rating of this?
I think it can pass PG. The second...
Fright scenes, you'd have to take a jump scene or two out. I mean, I don't know what the 1993...
Well, the second trilogy is also PG-13, and it's much more... Like, my kids kept looking at me when they would say certain things on screen, and I'm like, we'll let this slide this time. So.
The other...
I would keep the rating. I don't think it needs to be R, I don't know if... I mean, I don't...
Yeah.
Definitely not R.
No. No, those are safe for pirate movies.
That's right.
Has this movie aged well?
The CGI in this movie...
This is one of the movies with CGI and stuff that has aged really well.
The CGI is light years ahead of its contemporaries, but doesn't hold up to modern standards.
Right.
But the practical effects blow the pants off of CGI of modern standards.
Right. Yep. They're still staying the test of time. I was watching a video today kind of prepping for this episode, and talking about how like it's that mix of when they have the CGI characters, but then they mix in the real world effects.
Yeah,
it's done just so well. There's a scene where the dinosaur is chasing one of the Jeeps, and he hits the Jeep with his head. In that scene, it's not a practical dinosaur; it is a CGI dinosaur. But in that moment, you see the Jeep go from a good door to a dented door in a matter of seconds. It's those things that makes those CGI dinosaurs believable, because the world around that computer graphic is moving with it. And he goes like, "Oh yeah, I believe this." The water, like when the dinosaur is running through the rain and it's there's these little things that go, I'm running with this. This is good. Yeah. So yeah, I think
it was light years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And in fact, the newer trilogy leans too much on CGI.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Last two questions here. Would this be... Did you think this aged well? I don't know if we got your answer. Okay.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Didn't know if I cut you off there. I tend to do that. All right. Last two questions here.
The reason I say that is my kids will watch movies with us that are like in the 90s or even 80s, and they're just like, "This is so old, I don't want to watch this." And they didn't say that about
this. That's a great indicator. Yeah.
Yeah, my kids loved them.
Yeah. My daughter has not seen this movie yet. So
why not?
Well, she's two. So would this movie be in your personal top 250?
I think it would.
Top 250? 250? I don't even know if I've seen 250 movies, guys.
So you definitely have.
This question is more of a joke, but because we take our movies from the IMDb top 250, we then go, okay, if we were creating our own top 250, would this be on the list? So it's kind of a joke question, but in the same sense, would this be in the movies that you would put on a list of rewatchable movies.
It's also inspired by another podcast, and they rate every movie either best movie ever or worst movie ever.
Yeah.
It's binary.
Yeah.
So
that's crazy, but this is best movie ever for me. And that's on my list too. Like, this is, I mean, look, I, as much as I'm waxing, you know, effusive praise here on this movie, it is my favorite movie. Okay. So it is in my top one. but it isn't, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like valedictorian. But it's not like I don't think there are equal films, right? It's just, it's that for me, right? It's like, you know, this is my favorite pizza topping, even though I also like other pizzas, you know, but this is my favorite pizza topping, which is just garlic. So, So this is my favorite film. There are equally good films. I mean, I'll be honest, Top Gun Maverick ranked up there for me, and I very unexpectedly, I was just like, this is just a good, this is just a good thrill. You know, and is it as good as Jurassic Park? No, it doesn't hit all the same notes for me, but that's a different sort of thing. And also, I was at a formative age when I fell in love with Jurassic Park and it was into dinosaurs and all that. So, but as a film, there are quote unquote better films or equally well told stories using film, if you will. So it's not like it'll never be touched and people can't tell better stories and do better CGI and do better acting. Like, it's, but it's got all the components that make something.
And really we agree when we've discussed this question for 40 some episodes now, like a lot of it for us is like, there's some, there's a nostalgic aspect to it and stuff. And so,
there's a connection,
which I think
it.
Is completely valid. Like that's,
and there's movies that's a personalization that have no nostalgia for us. There's movies that we've seen for the first time for this podcast. And we're like, top 250 all time, easy.
So it's been fun to go through this journey because we're learning new things about how we rank films and stuff too. And don't get us started on ranking. I have a system that doesn't mean it makes sense, but I have a system. Anyways, last question, and this one's a little bit more serious, but like, and it also is more weighted.
This is my favorite one.
If we didn't like the film. Yeah. But the fact that we're all on the same side here, like, but why do you think this movie is on the IMDb top 250?
Doug, you first.
Well, I mean, you kind of gave it away with like, it didn't make it till 2012, which would have been, like, I don't know. Why were people watching it in 2012? I guess it would have been the 30th.
It was still well past the third Jurassic Park movie, and they hadn't yet announced the Jurassic World.
Yeah, 2000.
So it makes no sense.
Yeah, 2001 was Jurassic Park 3.
Okay, so there's nothing like, hey, we're going to go back and watch the first one kind of thing. Why is it on the list? I'm really curious why I didn't make it the list until later, but why is it on the list? I mean, it's just a classic film that's got all the right ingredients. And for people who are watching it at some point, you know, later in life, maybe it probably hit a streaming service and more people were able to vote on it. That might be part of it.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
So there could be that component of it. That's probably it. I didn't
think about the streaming.
It's just a good film. And if people watch, like, that's the thing. It didn't have enough votes at first, right? So, but why is it on there? And why is it, I mean, it's at what? You said 144 right now? Or 170, something like within 200,
144,
right? So whatever number it's on now, 144, that's fairly high. Right, given the number of films out there, given even on
thousands of
years, you're barely hitting the top half. You're still in the bottom half.
Thousands of new films added every year, and this is in the top 250 of all films.
Yeah, so and I mean, it's still in slightly the bottom half, which makes sense. I mean, I can understand that. I don't know. I don't really have an answer other than like more people got to see it finally, and it still holds up.
For me, like I would have to say Spielberg has a lot to do with it. I think it comes in swinging. Well, I don't disagree with what you're saying either, though. But just to add to that, like having the weight of Spielberg on it, and the things he did with this movie that innovated future films, the combination of CGI and practical, I think that for me, I think Spielberg had a lot to do with it. If another director did this, maybe still be a good movie, but like people were going to watch it because of Spielberg. Yeah. And I do know with the first trailer for this movie, the very first trailer for this movie, when they started teasing it and they started marketing it before it aired in theaters, showed zero footage from the movie.
Really?
It had shots of microscopes. It had unused DNA, like the DNA figure footage, the little DNA character. It showed other footage of people harvesting the amber. But yeah, so the first, whether it was a teaser trailer or just a trailer, it had zero footage from the movie.
I actually remember that.
Below.
Yeah.
I actually remember that, having seen the movie, thinking, I'm surprised you brought that up. But I actually think, wait a second, the trailer didn't even have
so just, I think, but people went in, this was 20 years after Jaws. That was 70s. Wow. This was 90s. Like, it's like people knew Spielberg. Like there was a lot of weight to that, I think. And I think Spielberg had a lot to do with it. Not saying that he shouldn't, but I think that that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Nelson?
So Spielberg definitely has an effect. Crystal Skull, sorry, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Minority Report, E.T., and Close Encounters of the Third Kind were all on the top 250 at one point, but aren't currently.
Crystal Skull was?
Yeah.
That fascinates me.
Yeah, especially considering...
seriously. I forgot about Minority Report. I forgot Spielberg did that. That's up in there. That's
I've
my
not
top
seen
10.
That.
I think it's wild that Crystal Skull made it to the top 250, but Temple of Doom didn't.
Yeah.
But I think Spielberg has a part to play. I think all of what you said as well, Doug, has a part to play. I think one of the biggest reasons is that the practical effects have aged so well that this movie's somewhat timeless.
Mm-hmm.
One of the hardest things to nail with CGI is lighting around the edges. And this movie doesn't do a great job with it, but it does better than anything else that came out in 93. By far. And so I think the practical effects and the passable CGI, mm-hmm. I think that's a big factor here.
Yeah.
None of the other Jurassic Park movies, even with their bigger budgets, I don't think even really quite hold a candle to how effective the practical effects in the first one were.
Yeah. And I mean, we can mention too, like John Williams on the score.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's also gotten a boost every time that a new Jurassic Park movies come out.
Yeah, it's, yeah. And I think this one deserves to be on the top 250.
I agree.
It's for many different reasons that we've all stated and stuff. It's
all right. Anything else?
That's all I've got.
Doug, before we wrap up here, anything that you would like to plug?
That I would like to plug? Oh, man, let's see.
Where can our listeners find you?
Yeah.
Where can our listeners find you? Yeah, so... So my work is at the Libertarian Christian Institute, which is libertarianchristians.com. And we do not produce films. We do not dabble in dinosaurs. But we do promote a Christian case for a free society. And in order to do that, I'm going to pitch, we need money because we like to be funded so that we can do the work that we're going to do, just like you guys do with your Patreon and stuff. So we're actually a 501c3 nonprofit. So donations actually are nice. Tax deductible if you like that kind of thing. LibertarianChristians.com. We create a lot of content. We create podcasts. We write articles and publish them. Which is part of why you see them. And we also write books. And we have some things in the works for 2024, and we are in that season right now of basically saying, hey, if you're considering giving, maybe consider giving to LCI because we create great content. Or maybe you're not into giving and you're just like, wait, what's a libertarian Christian? I don't know. What are the core values? Go to our website. You can get all of that there. And even if you aren't inclined to be a libertarian, or for that matter, a Christian, there's still really good material there for you because, you have to be interested in one or the other, but there's still really good material there for you. So libertarianchristians.com.
I found your book, Faith Seeking Freedom, to be extremely helpful. And, I subscribe to all your podcasts. Not all your podcasts are currently producing content, though. What are currently active podcasts that people can find from LCI?
Yeah, so we have a Christians for Liberty Network, which has officially 8 podcasts or 8 shows, and they are at varying levels of like distribution. So when you're saying that, hey, they're not all producing, well, they could be a hiatus or in between seasons or that kind of thing. But right now we have the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, which is run by Alex Bernardo, who he does one a week, but like every it seems like every other week he's sneaking a second one in, and which is fine. But he just has these interviews. He just keeps going and going and going. He's our little Energizer Bunny right now. Jacob Winograd does the Biblical Anarchy podcast. We talked about him earlier. We actually have a new podcast out. I should have thought about this. It's called Faith Ventures. And Norman Horn is doing this one, which is why Faith Seeking Freedom podcast has been sort of on a hiatus for a little bit. The Faith Ventures podcast is about telling stories of Christians who do business to the glory of God, and what is their journey like, and what does their venture look like, as it were. And so these are about 25 to 35 minute episodes. Norman has a conversation. It's very similar in each episode, where he talks to the guests about their journey, asks everybody a specific question at the end. I think it's in every episode, where he asks all the guests the same question. So it's our newest podcast. We have 12 episodes. It's only been out a month. We did like two a week for a while, and now we're doing one a week, just to kind of get a bunch out there in the library. So anyway, Faith Ventures is the podcast, but I pitched libertarianchristians.com, but also christiansforliberty.net would actually be a good place to go if you want to see all of our, so either one would be fine. It kind of lands at the same spot. But those are our active podcasts. Oh, well, and mine, the Libertarian Christian podcast. I'm pitching everybody else's podcast, but my own. Humble. Yeah. So, well, I haven't actually done any episodes for a couple of weeks, because I either did them long ahead, or we're doing some repeat episodes from like 3-4 years ago, because some people haven't heard them, because we've gotten a lot of audience since then. So anyway, that's the gist there. But we are wrapping up our year, doing some fundraising and some things like that. And next year we have big plans and big dreams. So libertarianchristians.com.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I would say, if you're not entirely disgusted by my political radicalism, definitely go check out all the podcasts over at LCI. They've gotten some incredible content there, incredible articles as well. Doug, thank you so much for spending this evening with us. We've appreciated your time.
Yeah.
We hope to have you back in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Next week, linked below, is the best years of our lives. We're going back in time here. So linked below is where you can watch that through Amazon Prime. Best years of our lives. Thanks again, Doug, for spending the evening with us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we would love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.